Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. It's been a rocky and rolling 6 weeks since we talked with George Polisner, a former senior executive at Oracle who very publicly resigned from the company after its CEO enthusiastically joined the Trump transition team in January. Since quitting Oracle, George has devoted his time to building the resistance movement to stop Trump. This morning, we checked back with George to talk about the state of the movement after weeks of massive protests and rowdy town hall meetings with members of Congress around the country. We'll get his take on how the ongoing onslaught of scandals plaguing the Trump administration can be harnessed to bring down this unprecedented and terrifying presidency. George, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Hello, and welcome. Thank you very much for having me back on the show.
Well, last time we touched base, I had no idea we could be talking about the latest scandal of the Trump administration. So let's kind of start with what we're faced here with right now, with the tweets over the weekend coming from the, I guess we'll call them number 45, and how that fits into the organizing that you've been working on since we last talked in January to try to overturn his autocracy.
Well, you know, I'm really convinced that this is not an administration like any administration, that this really far more closely resembles a crime syndicate. And it's really an international crime syndicate when you think about it. And you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist or anything like that, but when you look at the inner circle of this administration and the cabinet appointments, there are so many close ties to Russia and Putin, and there's so much money at stake in between joint ventures between ExxonMobil and Rosneft, the national petroleum industry of Russia. It's really disconcerting. And so, you know, what I see on the ground is we still have a lot of people that are very focused, even perhaps more so than the beginning of this this administration, on trying to protect and defend those that we know that are going to be most vulnerable to the really egregious policies that are going to continue to come out of this administration and the GOP-led Congress. But what we really need is some GOP senators and representatives to do something that would be pretty unusual for them to do, and that's to put the interests of America ahead of the interests of the GOP party.
Well, the thing that was so astonishing to me about Trump's tweets this weekend, where he's accusing Obama of wiretapping Trump Tower during the election campaign without any basis at all for the charges, and then basically having his spokespeople, Conway and Spicer, say, well, because he said it, it must be true. The thing I really love was Conway conflating the accusations that Trump made this weekend about Obama with the accusations that the FBI has been making about there being possible collusion between the Trump administration and Russians. Conflating these two things is really very strange. Just one, there's evidence, there's wiretap evidence. The other one is just what Trump's saying, what's in his mind and what he's hearing on Breitbart. How do we deal with a government where there is actually no government and, as you say, it's basically a crime syndicate?
The way that we have to continue to place pressure first of all, on those that we know that are going to advocate for us in government, and that's our usual suspects in the House and the Senate. But we also need to start working on Republicans that have already stated concerns, such as Lindsey Graham and John McCain. What's interesting about this is the more that the GOP prolongs or obstructs any kind of investigation into this administration, the closer they become to co-conspirators. And there has to be a tipping point at some point in time that the statements are becoming more outlandish. And they're clearly distractions or are likely distractions from the evisceration of the EPA and Betsy DeVos at the Department of Education and attacks on voter rights. This is all intended to distract us, I believe. But in any event, Republicans that are interested in preserving their majority in 2018 and looking towards 2020 have to be somewhat concerned. And I believe that as long as Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell know that they have rubber stamp approval in the executive office for anything they want to do from a policy perspective and mechanisms that they use to concentrate wealth to their donors and the already obscenely wealthy, they'll continue to work with this administration. But I also believe that in many respects, Mike Pence is their insurance policy. And that is, you know, should, I call him Trump Putin, but should 45, you know, continue to really overstep and make these outlandish statements and create frustration among socially moderate, fiscally conservative Republicans by, you know, traveling down to Florida with his entourage on a weekly basis, costing taxpayers millions of dollars. There's going to be a turning point. And so the strategy, from my perspective, is we continue to keep pressure on. We don't normalize this behavior. The work that's going on in terms of marches, scientists getting together, women's groups getting together, the pressure has to continue from a public perspective, and the pressure has to continue on our elected officials to do what's right for America. I think everybody is continuing on this path, and my hope and concern is that people don't become disengaged or give up or frustrated, because we have to be prepared to lose. When we fight against an executive order and we get some wins in the courts, and then the executive order is redrafted and then presented in a way in which it is defensible, this is going to happen, and we have to be prepared to lose, but we have to continue to march forward.
Now, what did you mean by Mike Pence is our insurance policy?
Well, not our insurance.
Their insurance policy.
Yeah.
Okay.
They know that, you know, I consider him extreme fundamentalist, but they know from a deep conservative perspective, they could impeach Donald Trump. If Donald Trump oversteps or creates what they consider to be too much risk for the party, and then they could move Mike Pence into the role of president.
Now, do you see any possibility that the Republicans, by not separating themselves from Trump soon enough, could totally discredit themselves and really throw us into a constitutional crisis if the pressure continues to have the investigations and the investigations turn up what a lot of people are suspicious are going to be shown up?
You know, yes and no. If you look at things from a logical and reasonable perspective, which is, I think you and I share this, you would think that would be an absolute risk. But if you look at everybody that was essentially debating Donald Trump as part of, you know, the RNC debates, there was nobody there that would speak, I think, from a reasonable perspective and work on the best societal outcomes for America. So I don't think that they have, you know, a huge concern about being tied to an extreme fundamentalist. I think extreme fundamentalists at this point in time are, you know, the core of their party.
Well, I think that's true, but I'm just wondering if there's enough, like, absolutely illegal and possibly treasonous activity that's revealed, and the Republicans haven't separated themselves with a decent interval, that this whole thing, I mean, if this is dependent on this, if this investigation actually happens, though part of me is kind of optimistic that it is going to happen, because I think there's no way to avoid that. Then I wonder if the Republicans don't at some point really soon say this is enough of Trump and we need to, like, really call him on what he's doing, that they're going to tumble along with Trump when his undoing happens.
I think that there certainly is a risk, but I don't think it's as big of a risk as we would like it to be, because they really do a good job of separating themselves. I mean, they ultimately would have to lead the impeachment proceedings, and in doing so, even if they do it late, They, as a matter of fact, they may intentionally do it. They may want to do it closer to 2018 so they can show, look, we're the, you know, we're the people's party, and even if it's our own, we'll go after them if they're corrupt. So, I mean, in some, you know, I have mixed feelings about that.
Well, I actually was thinking, this has sort of been my fantasies ever since Trump was elected, about, you know, when the impeachment would happen. It seemed like it was inevitable, and what the impact would be on the Republicans. And thinking back to 1998-99, when Clinton was impeached, I think that did a lot of damage to the Democrats, and it kind of weakened Al Gore's presidential aspirations. And so I just wonder, that was my thought, that if the Republicans look that bad, by 2018, they might really be in the toilet, especially if there's an impeachment which undercuts so much of what they were saying and trying to do for the previous years.
I think more of their risk is the application of their policies and the continued promotion of, you know, what I consider to be a massive fraud perpetrated upon the middle class and the poor, called trickle down. And so I really think it's there. If the people that were hurting as part of the 2016 election cycle, the people that were really economically disadvantaged, and rightfully so, I mean, dating back since the Reagan era, through the concentration of wealth and tax policy and privatization and externalities that has led to this growing abyss between people that have and people that don't. If the people that have been severely harmed by this policy wake up and finally understand that these are the policies of the GOP, and that the 2016 election cycle, they were really sold a bill of goods and manipulated into voting for policy that is very harmful for them. If they wake up and understand that, I think that's actually going to have far more impact than the, you know, potential impeachment of Trump Putin.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with George Paulsner, who achieved a certain amount of fame a couple months ago when he resigned very publicly from Oracle because of his opposition to the position Oracle CEO took with supporting Trump. And he's since then, and actually prior to that, a very strong Democratic activist, both Democrat with a big D and a small D, right, George?
You know, I have been, and it's not necessarily, I consider myself really more leaning towards progressive policy, and I've been very active in the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party from a platform perspective, I think, is far more closely aligned with the America that I would like to see, which is predicated on fairness and justice and opportunity for every American, regardless of what you believe and who you love and what you look like. And so, but I'm more tied to outcomes than I am to party. And so, you know, do I agree with everything the Democratic Party does? You know, maybe not. But I see myself more closely aligned.
Well, before we get into talking more about the kinds of amazing organizing that's been going on and how that can be sustained and even enhanced, I wanted to talk a bit about the latest travel ban that I got a little alert on my phone just before I came, and it was, and it wouldn't go away. It's just to remind me that Trump is just always there now. But what do you know about what's in that travel ban? What makes you think that it would be harder to be thrown out in court than the last one?
My understanding is the way that it's been written, the way that it's been architected, is it is more likely to withstand any kind of legal challenge. And I'm not familiar with the underlying legal technicalities. And I do know that this particular ban, which is really a ban on the Muslim community, excludes Iraq, and the previous ban did not, and my understanding, limited understanding, is that Iraq lobbied pretty heavily, and so I don't know if that means that Rex Tillerson's got an oil deal in Iraq now, or if there's going to be a Trump hotel rising up in the middle of Baghdad. I'm not sure, but of course I'm always very, very suspicious. But in regardless whether it's six countries or seven countries, the intent is egregious, I know and have had the privilege of working with many in the Muslim community, and you know the exclusion of any class of people is so antithetical to the principles of America and the founding of America that it fills me with absolute disgust.
Now, does it still have a preference for Christian immigrants than Muslim immigrants, or do they kind of soft pedal that part?
I'm not sure. I haven't seen the actual text of the executive order. So, and I do know that was disconcerting too, that somehow what Christians are subjected to versus, you know, Muslims. I mean, anybody fleeing from violence and terror, is somebody that we should be welcoming with open arms. I mean, we should not in America be cowering in fear, hiding behind gates or walls. It's unfortunate. It's characterizing all Americans as being, you know, fearful little scaredy cats that are afraid of, you know, women and children that are fleeing torture and horror.
Well, I'm wondering if it still has that preference for Christian refugees, that would be grounds, that seems like that would be the same grounds that were the grounds for overturning the last executive order.
Right. And I'm fairly certain that they would not have made the same mistake twice. And so however the last order was effectively attacked in court, I'm sure that if that was fundamentally the legal issue in which the courts overturned the enforcement capability of that executive order, I'm sure they've excluded that part.
And I guess they've also excluded the part about people with green cards. But
right.
We'll be curious. I wouldn't be surprised if there are going to be court challenges coming up very soon anyway. And I'm sure that all those legal entities have been already framing their lawsuits, waiting to have this second shoe drop. So,
and you know, those lawsuits, so the marches and a lot of the public protests and demonstration and advocacy work, tweeting and communicating with elected officials are incredibly important. But even more important right now are going to be organizations like the ACLU and Public Citizen and Earth Justice, as well as a lot of the Democratic attorneys general, because we have to, in terms of protecting and defending, it's really going to be the courts where we have our biggest advantage. I mean, Mitch McConnell in the Senate or Paul Ryan in the House are not going to be that impressed by hundreds of thousands of signatures coming from California Democrats or Oregon Democrats about what we perceive as really egregious policy. Getting things tied up in the court while we work on a massive citizens movement in 2018 and into 2020 and beyond is what's going to be vital for us.
Now, did you see the cover of, or see the last issue of the Nation? Well, actually, it's 2 weeks ago's issue. And there's the cover is a picture of Donald Trump, and it has Oregon, Washington, and California is like tape covering his eyes and his mouth. But there's an article that that cover reference to about basically that there is this wall of resistance along the West Coast to Trump and how powerful that wall of resistance can be. Is that something that you've tapped into yet?
We tapped into it, I think, in the initial, you know, Attorney General's response in Washington to the first executive order travel ban. And, you know, I think that, California going out and hiring and retaining Eric Holder is important, and I think it's really strategic. I mean, it's understanding that the place where we can effectively win or at least delay bad policy until we can change the political landscape is in the courts. And so, you know, I've also, you know, seen articles where California, Oregon, and Washington have joined Canada, and I have to say that has some appeal at this point in time, too, with respect to health care.
Yeah, actually, I'm thinking about my show next week. We're going to be talking about the war on science. And I spent a lot of time up in Canada a couple of years ago before Justin Trudeau became prime minister, and talked with a lot of people about the Canadian war on science under Stephen Harper, which went on for 12 years, almost as long right. as Hitler, actually. And and it was a very scary time. When I was up there and listening to all these people who were trying to fight the pipelines going from the tar sands to the British Columbia coast, and trying to fight the tar sands and trying to, you know, really stave off the kind of ignorance that was being fomented by the Harper administration, it made me kind of heartbroken, because Canada had always been my kind of safe haven back to the 70s, and a place that I kind of idealized as a really wonderful society. And so I saw how bad Canada could get. So there, I am a little leery about joining Canada, because I don't really trust that it will, you know, stay great. But I think it's kind of interesting to see the flip-flop, and to see that a lot of the issues that Canada was having, a lot of the problems, particularly around science and having science be respected for being science, as opposed to being opposed to some fundamentalist oil belief of Stephen Harper, that we're seeing that now they reinstated all the scientific freedom and the and really engaging and doing proactive work to support good scientific research and listening to what the research bears. So now we're having the reverse here in this country. What do you think we can learn from Canada's experience, and maybe not go there as quickly as Canada did under the Stephen Harper days?
Well, you know, apparently nothing, because, I mean, beyond Canada, we're repeating the same lessons of the Europe in the 1930s. And, you know, the fact that we've elected a government, an administration that is, you know, that uses strategy and tactics that are what, you know, our past generations fought and died against is deeply disturbing. And so I think that from my perspective, we have to protect and defend over the next couple of years. But what's imperative is we have to understand that if we are going to aspire towards democracy, that the fundamental principles are unfettered information and an educated populace. And we've seen the dumbing down of America for generations, and we've seen media consolidation really start to control how information is distributed to the American public. We've seen, beginning with Reagan, an erosion of the quality of American life, to the point where people are working harder and longer for less money, and they don't necessarily have time to understand or research issues. And these are all attacks on democracy. These are all attacks on our ability to effectively understand the issues, understand the candidates, there's more to just simply being able to vote and not having your vote suppressed by the GOP through the mechanisms that they use. It's understanding the issues and being well informed and being able to take time and to be in your community, to talk to your neighbors and understand the issues. And these are all things that have been eroded over the course of many years. And I'm deeply disturbed by the attacks, as you say, on science and the pursuit of knowledge. I mean, these are the things, you know, beyond aspirations of democracy, when you think about the very, very best of humanity. It's when we can get together and put people on the moon, or we can do amazing things together in a collaborative way with people all around the world. Trying to help solve issues of hunger and address people's suffering and the furtherance of science and medicine to ease people's suffering. And when we see that beginning to be constrained by an administration or any group of people whose main goal is to just concentrate wealth and perpetuate their own power, it's an attack on everyone, not only in America or in Canada, but everywhere around the world.
Well, Bill Maher last weekend was talking about how we basically have two strongholds against the power of the Trump administration. And one was the courts, but he says, but judges die and they'll be replaced by Republicans. So that leaves us with the press. And then he had this wonderful plea to the press to stay free and to stay critical and to stay strong. And I thought it was interesting. I watched the press over the last week, starting with the Jeff Sessions revelations, and then the way they responded to Trump's tweets about Obama bugging the Trump Towers. And I was impressed. I wondered, what have you thought about press coverage this weekend? Do you think that they're holding up to the standard that Bill Maher wants him to hold to?
You know, I it's funny. I just wrote a note to Dan Rather this morning talking about how I grew up watching Walter Cronkite and Eric Severide and Dan, you know, anchor the CBS evening news. And it's really, it's imperative. I mean, you know, when we talk about the pillars of democracy, you know, resting upon education and information, it's the fourth estate that is responsible to inherently responsible to inform people so we can aspire towards democracy. And, you know, when I hear stay strong, I think, no, really, they need to get strong. You know, they, and I don't fault journalism. I think that even, you know, when you look at broadcast news and the fact that these used to be lost leaders, they used to be kind of the crown jewel of a network, and they were set up and they knew that money was going to be lost, but they wanted to truly provide a public service that would make their network and delineate their network from the other networks. But now these are all profit centers. And so and this is a problem with capitalism, capitalism isn't all bad. I mean, certainly it creates efficiencies in some areas, and it can lead to innovation in some areas. But when everything becomes a profit center, it's no longer about providing a public service. It's about generating and maximizing profit. And so if you have some really great journalists, and you can hire some kids out of school at minimum wage, you know, you're going to get the kids out of school at minimum wage. And so, all you know, if we're really serious about a democracy in America, Americans really need to rethink what we fund and what we allocate our resources to, and education and journalism, and you know, getting access to unfettered information is our imperatives.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with George Polisner, who is organizing to save our democracy after resigning from Oracle this past winter in protest over his CEO joining the Trump administration's transition team. I'm curious, what do you think of the coverage of, particularly over the weekend, the way that the press responded to Trump's tweets?
You know, I'm still bitter because I think I blame the press for the Trump problem to begin with. And so I think that there's a lot of makeup work to be done. And it's showing promise, but you know, the trends of the past, you know, even through the Bush administration, Bush and Cheney, the press largely wasn't there for us. I think that years, or even generations of erosion, for whatever reason, you don't recover that over the course of coverage of a weekend or even a couple of months.
So the proof is in the pudding, what they do coming up. And
that's right, in a sustained way, and with hopefully a growing presence in both domestic and foreign coverage.
Well, what would you like to see them do? Let's take the latest outrage. So we'll take the weekend tweets. How would you like to see them deal with that material so that they're not just being distracted by it and not covering what's in the health care plan, too, that's going to be revealed. The secret health care plan is going to be revealed any day now, or this travel ban, which actually is getting a lot of press. But what do you see that you'd like, how would you like to see them cover the next week?
I think that I would like to see continuing coverage in a balanced way. And when I say balanced, I don't mean there are multiple sides of 2 + 2 = 4. When I say balanced, I mean coverage of all of the important issues, whether it's, you know, suspected mental health impairments coming from this administration, or as you said, you know, something as vitally important to this country as healthcare, that needs to be covered, and the press really needs to inform with respect to when the GOP announces whatever their health plan is. I'm sure will range from anything from the statement, you know, let them die, which was yelled out, I think, at one of the candidates. I don't know if it was Rand Paul or something like that when they were talking about healthcare and the ACA. But they need to be able to not only address the lack of a healthcare plan or the fact that nobody's seen it, but they need to do a good job making the information accessible to the average American. And so if the GOP health plan is, hey, you get tax credits for your health plan, then people that are impoverished in America, in which tax credits may mean very little to offset, you know, their capital gains taxes or investment income, people need to understand that this GOP plan is leaving them out in the cold. And so that's the kind of information. It's information and some real analysis that the average person can understand.
Well, in the remaining minutes, I'd like to talk about what you're doing right now to counter all this, because we talked on the phone shortly after you were on the air in January about some of your plans to do education about what democracy is. So what are your plans?
It's actually the plans have started to happen, and I've got volunteers now working in the United States and around the world. On a social media platform which is geared towards civic engagement and civic action called CivWorks, CIV.WRKS. And we launched on February 14th. And so we went from leaving Oracle and wondering for a day what I'm going to do next into building this. And what we're doing is we've created a platform in which we hope to really counter activist overload or feeling overwhelmed. We're trying to create a platform in which personalized civic actions or opportunities for civic action or engagement are presented to the people that use CivWorks based upon their location and the issues that they care about. So, for example, if you're really big on public education, we would be sending actions to you saying, you know, hey, at 3 p.m. tomorrow, there's going to be a meeting of the school board candidates at, you know, the Wilsonville Library, for example. And so what we want to do is we don't want to overwhelm people. We don't want to send them, you know, a list of 20 things to do that are fairly generic. We're using behavioral mechanisms to really engage people and engage them in a way in which that energy can be sustained.
So
I have a lot of hope, and there's a lot of interest, and we're continuing to work as fast as we can to get the improvements into the system that we know we need to do.
So how do people get connected to that system?
So right now it's invite only, and so because we are a nonprofit and we're trying to control. We don't want to have to go out and buy Amazon's data center just yet, nor could we. And so it's invite only, but if people go to CivWorks, CIV.WORKS, they can learn about the platform and they can request an invite.
And we'll put a link to that on our website so that people can follow up on that after the show.
Fantastic.
The other thing, we had a conversation on the phone that I also appreciated, talking about having people understand what democracy is. And
yes.
How are you going about doing that?
So we're building this platform out, and the other part of the platform is really geared toward helping bring people together across political boundaries or across political lines on the basis of issues. And so that's one way. So to give you an example, you could be a Republican voting mom in Topeka, Kansas, or a Green voting, you know, dad in Marin County, California, and neither of you wants to turn your kitchen sink on and get a flammable, toxic, leaded sludge coming out of your sink. At least I would hope not. And so there are issues that we care about, and I believe as Americans, there are more issues that we and values that we share in common, but we're divided intentionally and polarized as a way to continue to conquer us and get us to vote against our own self-interest. So The platform will actually be looking at bringing people together on the basis of issues and values we share in common. And then the other thing that I would really love to see, and I've had discussions with some media companies because it's well beyond my budget or creativity, and that's to create a series on the values that we do share and have in common, and visually show them, because I think people think in terms of pictures and can relate far better to pictures and film as they can to, you know, speeches and articles. And so just some brief films that talk about, you know, why healthcare should be a human right. You know, why should we be letting, you know, people that are impoverished, do we want them to wait until they have some sort of health catastrophe and then go to the emergency room to be treated, which we all have to pay for and is invariably far more expensive than if we had paid for them to have some sort of preventative medicine. And so it's an education an opportunity for people to learn more about these issues in a fair and unfettered way that I think will connect with people. Because, you know, I have discussions and with people who are very conservative but religious, and I ask them, you know, you're part of a religious community and you believe, you know, strongly in you know, your religion. What part of your religion, you know, basically teaches you that poor people should, you know, have to self-treat and get infections and die because they don't get access to fundamental health care? And so I think that there are things that we all share and hold in common, and I want to reconnect Americans with those things.
Well, one last thing. You talked in the beginning of the show about having to reach out to Republicans, and we need to have some strong Republican leadership if we're going to free this country from the grips of the kleptocracy of the Trump administration. Do you have any sense about what people can do to start reaching those Republicans?
You know, I suspect that there are some extreme people on both sides of the issue that I really don't hold much hope in terms of having a dialogue with or being able to reach. But I do think that, and well, not even think, I know that there are some socially moderate, fiscally conservative Republicans that tell me, you know, George, we believe that climate change is human-made and we do need climate change action if we're going to have a planet, but don't touch my long-term capital gains taxes. And so they're out there, and we may not believe, we certainly may not be aligned on every issue, but it's the conservatives that aren't looking to attack women's rights or the LGBTQ community and have an understanding. You know, they don't want to pass out free stuff, you know, but neither do Democrats. But there's the debate is framed by other people that paint or characterize, you know, progressives as just, you know, wanting to, you know, enable behaviors and give out free stuff. You know, we believe in hard work too, and it's a question of reclaiming that, and it's a question of having the conversations with conservatives in a very pragmatic way that basically says, you know, we probably believe in many things very, very similar to you. We may have different ideas on how to get there, but let's talk first about what we share in common, and maybe that can give us some space in terms of whether something can be handled better by the private sector or by government or how we can architect solutions and change. So I think it's possible, but I don't think it's possible with everyone at this point.
Well, two senators come to mind. One is Susan Collins, the other one is Lisa Mazursky. I can't think of anybody else that I think would listen to you fully. I mean, every so often I have hope for Lindsey Graham or John McCain or I think Jeff Flake, but mostly they're being pretty disappointing. So is there anybody you have in your pocket, you think, besides Mazursky and Collins?
Nobody in my pocket. I haven't achieved Koch brothers.
You got to make more money.
I think Susan Collins is a great example. And when she mentioned that she was certainly interested in potentially pursuing Trump's tax returns as part of her investigation, then I actually wrote her a note saying, you know, I'm a Democrat, but I'm writing to thank you. And this is, you know, this is not a Democrat or Republican issue. This is an America issue. And I'm grateful for your leadership and courage to state publicly that you would do this. And so I think that's something that's a good example of what we can do, is when Republicans do speak out or when Republicans do act, we need to reinforce that behavior. I mean, we spend a lot of time yelling at each other, but when good things happen, we need to reach out across the aisle and say, and I think that helps, because suddenly, we're not all just a bunch of liberals marching through the streets throwing bricks through, Bank of America windows, which I know we don't do, but it gives us the opportunity to dialogue and to, I think, not be objectified by the other side.
Well, we got to cut it at this point, but it's really great to talk with you, George. I really appreciate your work, and we'll definitely stay in touch.
Wonderful. Thank you so much again. I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks a lot. We've been talking this morning with political organizer George Polisner, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk about the war on science with Colin O'Mara, who's with the National Wildlife Federation. My engineer is Betsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the band. Thanks for listening.
Now when the rumor comes to your town, it goes and grows. Where it started, no one knows. Some